That's the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm chatting to someone who, he could be one of those people where you say he needs no introduction, because he's pretty famous, really, in the world of advertising, and has been for all the time I've been in it, 20 years. So you could say he needs no introduction, but he actually does, because when I was going through his stuff, his background and all the things he's been involved in, I realized that despite the fact that we went through a lot of interesting subjects, there were still plenty of other ones I could have talked to him about. There were plenty of things we could have really gone into and spent a lot of time on. One of them being his involvement with the Labour Party and the election campaigns for the Labour Party, I think in 2003, was it, or two, four? I don't know, around that time, and maybe the one after. Anyway, we didn't get into that, but we got into dozens of other subjects, which were all fascinating. I mean, I'm lucky enough that when I was freelancing, we sort of came into each other's orbit because Daryl had done an ad for the D-Day landings on the BBC and created a really fantastic piece of film with Mike Nicholson. And Trevor wanted to use it as a thing for D-Day 65th anniversary to create an appeal to get people to sponsor the veterans going back. So that was great. And he got us involved in that. And we designed a poster for him as well. And that was really cool. So it was just interesting being in his orbit, I guess, because he'd been in this sort of place where he was Trevor Beattie in inverted commas before then, because he had this sort of, I don't know, legend and aura, and he'd heard the stories and all these kind of things. And meeting him, he's just a really nice, down-to-earth bloke. So he's got a great record as a creative, great record as a CD, as a chairman, as someone who started his own agency, as someone who's got into the whole space travel thing by offering to do a whole campaign for Virgin Galactic, Muhammad Ali's boxing gloves. You know, the story's one after the other. And unlike the other people I've interviewed, I guess for them, the important thing is the work and the work that they've done. And although Trevor's created some really fantastic stuff, there are a lot of far more interesting things about him, to be honest. No offense to the work, but that's just the sort of tip of the iceberg. So sorry it was only an hour, but there's a point where I can't fit more on the thing, on the website. And also, I can't take up that much more of Trevor's time because he's always got things to do. Anyway, here is one concentrated hour of me chatting to Trevor Beattie.
What I've done so far in the interviews, I've spoken to people, I just start at the beginning of their career and carry on. But I had a slightly different angle because I was saying,
rather not do that.
Well, I just think there's the, I don't know, I started in advertising in 95, 96, when you were a definite sort of big public figure in the industry. And, you know, since then, you've done some incredible things. But I think it's interesting how you are Trevor Beattie in inverted commas. You know, there's things I know about you, and I thought it'd be interesting to ask you about those separate little things because they're all so interesting. And rather than go chronologically through your career, maybe I could just start with that level of sort
well,
of.
Well, I delete it every 5 years, so there's no point in asking me anything from 5 years ago.
Fantastic.
And so I hate the whole chronological.
Great.
Anyway.
Okay. Well, I mean, you more than I think nearly anyone else in the time I've been advertising are a famous person in the industry. And I was kind of wondering if there was something deliberate about that. Did you try to do that? Because I would open the Sun and see your name regularly in articles, and there was no one else in our industry doing that. So was there a method to that?
Yeah, I answered the phone when journalists called. That's literally all it was. It was never an intention. It was never an ambition. But I didn't know any other way of doing it. So when a journo called the agency, and normally when that happens in our business, everyone runs and hides in the toilets because it's a journalist and you might say the wrong thing. I thought, great, yeah, I'll talk to them. I'm really proud of what I've done. It's just that. In a way, it was nothing to do with advertising. It was, or PR. It was pride, really. I just wanted to talk about the stuff we'd done. It was great. That's all it was. It was no, not an ambition to be famous. That is the last thing I want to be. And I just like rode the horse. It just got a bit stranger.
Yeah, and I think there was the work to back it up, because obviously, you know, the work that was happening, particularly in that period in the mid-90s, the Hello Boys campaign, was famous in a way that I think now almost seems weird, because the idea of a billboard poster being famous is kind of strange. I remember that summer of 95, there was Eric, as you know, 66 was a great year for English football. There was the what was that smoking campaign? It said, "I smoke them because my name's on them." There were all these amazing posters all over the place, and Hello Boys was the one. So I think it's really fascinating that that was of that time. It seems weird now, because
I don't know why it still doesn't happen, because nothing's changed.
No,
you know, we might have digital billboards, but they're still billboards, and people still read them.
Yeah,
but with Wonderbar, the fundamental difference was that it was a media idea. It was the media guys who said, "We're going to put it on the streets," and lingerie had never been advertised outside of magazines before. So putting it in a public space is what caused the fuss, I think. I don't think they were brilliant hands in any way, or average hands. But the creative idea was where they were. I think that was it.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know why posters can't be famous now. I don't know. There's a lot of blandness. You would notice something that was well written now as well. You really would.
Yeah, they would definitely stand out. The next thing that I wrote down on my list is "The Weetabix Gang Made Me Buy Tammy / Bunty." Right, so I can't remember which, you did the Weetabix Gang, and the female one came with a girl's comic, and I went to my newsagent and bought the girl's comic so that I had all five of the Weetabix Gang. So can you explain what that campaign was and how it came about for I think a few of the people who are a bit younger and don't know about it?
Yeah, that's the first thing I ever wrote in my entire career. The original line was "Box Full of Little Bastards," which the creative director didn't approve. And then the next line was "Full of Natural Badness," which actually you could run now. And out of that came "If You Know What's Good For You." So, although I think it's unforgivable to put arms and legs on a product. So it's one of the great sins of advertising. It's like starting a commercial with the word "imagine." or introducing the all-new. I mean, you're in the States, you know that every other commercial on television begins with the immortal line, "Introducing the all-new."
Yeah.
You know, just wasting 4 seconds of airtime. And I think that putting arms and legs on a product is a scoundrel's way out. So I was young, I was only four.
So the idea that they look like skinheads then, was that like...
They just did, because if you put arms and legs on a Weetabix, you're not going to get Russell Brand, are you?
No.
So that's all it was. And the fact that they were hard and disgusting, and I still couldn't eat the things to save my life, the horrible things. It was the character. It was the combination, I guess, of something which is had been sold as intrinsically good for you being portrayed as bad. And it was the one cereal that kids would never... wouldn't want to eat because there's no sugar in it. So while they were demanding the Frosties and It's Great and all of this, Sugar Puffs and Cocoa Pops, they would never demand a lump of bran. I still don't. And so therefore, the revolutionary thing about it was that it made kids like your good self interested in a brick, a sugarless brick.
Yeah.
Which really good for them, you know. It was a weird thing. And it ran for years, I mean, long after I gave her up. I think it's quite sweet. If you do something and then years later you still see it running in different formats. I did a thing with Felix Cat Food, Cats Like Felix. And 12 years later, 15 years later, it was still running out of Diddy Billion. It's quite strange. It's like recognising an old friend, you know, when you see that. That still has a life of its own.
Yeah, it's interesting what has longevity and what doesn't. And I guess one of the other campaigns that has that was the lemonade drinker, secret lemonade drinker. And the reason I mention that is because the guy who wrote that gave you your first job?
Yeah, Rod Allen, yeah. Oh, White. So they both died now, and Peter Marsh died last year.
Yeah.
He was an extraordinary showman. Well, the first person to bring showmanship into advertising, I guess.
Absolutely. But I mean, I think the R. White's Lemonade Drinker, I don't know how long that went on for when I was a kid. It was the...
It was Secret Lemonade Drinker, and HSEL revisited it.
That's right.
They ran it again. It was just insert a celebrity here. But it's just a great song. It's just a great tune. I'm a Secret Lemonade Drinker. It was great.
So did you learn from, like, that guy about how to, anything about how to create ads in terms of jingles or what would make it famous?
Yeah, I do. I learned one thing from him, but it was enough. And that was, if the public can't remember who's advertising, it's a crap product. It's a crap ad, sorry. So if someone can talk about your ad without mentioning the brand name, it's a shit ad. So if you say, have you seen that extraordinary car ad? I think it's for Renault, but it could be Citroën. It's a crap ad. And what those guys taught me was that the name of the brand should be at the heart of what you do in your advertising. So although in advertising, it seems that we only occasionally get what we'd call a brand brief, where people would say, oh, we need to get the name of the brand out there. With those guys, that started with that, front and centre. Get the name out, and then what else do you want to tell me about it? Which I see less and less these days. But it's an interesting philosophy. I think Dave Trott has a bit of that about him. You mustn't separate the brand name from the things like Kanaka Knurps. There's no harm in that. There's no shame in shouting the name from the rooftops. And if anyone ever confused my ad for another brand, I think I'd failed.
Yeah, I think his latest column, in fact, just today, is about Bob Levinson saying exactly that. If you can look at a thing and take away the product, it's not really a thing. It's not really an ad. So there's that. And we had someone come in from a very cutting-edge type Snapchat company the other day into work, and he said, so here's this great ad for Hyundai. And he showed it to us, and it was actually for some other car company. And I said, well, actually, that's for Kia or whatever. And he said, just because I misremember the name, that's not important. And I thought, oh, my God, that's the only thing that's important.
It's the only thing that counts. That's extraordinary.
But I was like the old dinosaur at the back of the room complaining about, like, basics rather than...
Wanting to sell the actual product.
I know, yeah. Anyway, I think the first time I saw you, I was in a room with you. You set us a brief at Watford about Nissan, and we all worked on it, and you were kind enough to come and give us a crit and that kind of stuff and have us round to your agency. How did you actually become CD of TBWA at quite a young age, relatively speaking?
Because I wanted it so much. I think I was 29, but I wanted to be creative director. I really liked that job. And it's funny because I don't think anyone wants to be creative director anymore. They want the title, but they don't want to go to the meetings. At the time, I didn't realise it involved meetings, and I just really wanted it. It was my desire for that job that got me the job, I think. So I remember writing to Campaign because I wanted to write Private View a lot, and they said, you can't, because we only have creative directors writing Private View. And I was broken by that. So I used to write Private View columns and just send them in. and some kind of fan club, and I would just send them in and say, right, I thought that last week's was crap and here's what I would have said. And I just kept doing this, and they didn't print them, and then, because I wasn't a creative director. And then one day someone dropped out and failed to write it, and they said, okay, you got your chance, you're in. And so I got the chance to write it, and then a few months later I actually became a creative director. So then I was legitimate and I was able to do it. And it was that. I don't know, I just really wanted the job. I really wanted to be creative director.
Because TBWA, I guess, it went through a great period before you got there, when John Hegarty was in charge and they were doing great stuff like Lego and whatever. And then I don't think it had the same standing at all again until you got there. Was there a reason why TBWA was the place that you were aiming for to be the CD?
No, no, because TPWI came to me. I was at Homes Like Richie, and we merged. It was merger mania. You know, we had a merger every week, really. I seem to remember I had a boxer's record of merged 7-1-4, lost 3 at one stage. You know, it was very strange. And it was a bit like being on a cruise liner or something, where the landscape would change around you, but you never move from your office. So one day your agency would be called HKR, then it'd be called TBWA, then it'd be called HKR TBWA GGT or whatever. And it changed, seemed to change every week. And what you had to do was cling on and survive while the landscape changed around you. Very strange time. So TBWA came to me. That sounds a bit highfalutin. TBWA came to Homes Like Richie. We merged. And it was the best thing ever happened. Because the energy and the spark of TBWA was so great. It still is. And from what I'm reading on today's news, it's about to be great again. So.
Well, I work for them, so I can attest that they are indeed great. What's funny is one of the points later down my list is great private views. I mean, I think you and Jerry Moira wrote the best private views of anyone, and you seem to actually put the proper effort in. There was a point around that time where basically everyone just said, well, I'm going to look at today's ads like a football team. You know, we've got one that's every fucking week. It was like around Euro 96.
I've decided to ask all the young members of the Crash Club.
Oh, yes. That was the other one. Yeah, Janie, who's our...
Next up. What bugs me is the phrase next up, next out of the jiffy bag, next up, yeah. First up.
Next out of the bag.
It's so lazy, you know, and it's just. And then, of course, the other aspect is being terrified to say anything bad about an ad because, well, you see, Trevor, if you do that, when it comes to awards juries, they'll remember that and they'll vote you down. Well, fuck them. I don't care. They can slag off my work. I'll live, you know, so. Just being honest and entertaining is all you should be in private view. And I think the problem is it's a bit anonymous at the minute and a bit subdued.
Yeah, I remember. I think John Hegarty would not allow anyone at BBH to do private view
because of what you
just said. And I think it's got to be the smallest instance of I'd rather die standing up than live on my knees to actually do private view and say that ad that's not very good. It's not very good, is it? I mean, we were working with Danny Kleinman, and the week before he was asked to do private view, he didn't know it was our ad, and he sort of slagged it off, and then we had a pre-production meeting with him where he was very apologetic, and I was like, no, fuck it. If you don't like the ad, you don't like the ad. That's what that's private view is.
But there was a big misunderstanding as well, because people in the industry used to think, and maybe still do, that the writer chose the ads. This week I'm going to slag off this because I can. And that made it, in a way, read more arrogant than it was intended. Because, you know, until people started writing next out the jiffy bag, people really believed that you selected, like a TV critic, oh, I'm going to slag off this week. You know, and it wasn't that at all. You got the bag of stuff. And I would always try and find a theme between them, I think. But just be entertaining and honest, that's all.
Yeah, it's almost strange that people in advertising wouldn't take writing private view, which is giving you a giant, you know, platform to speak in the industry's biggest red newspaper, as not a way to convey something positive about yourself and go, look how clever and funny and whatever. And anyway, the next thing on my list is the FC UK row with David Abbott. And I don't bring this up in any way to try. I don't know if you, in any way you consider it awkward or anything like that. But watching it from the outside, I'm wondering what it felt like from the inside, from your point of view.
I absolutely loved it. He wrote a letter to Campaign. Remember letters? He wrote
on a quill pen.
He wrote a letter in which he used the word, I've got it somewhere, he used the word FCUK about 17 times to make his point that it was a really crap thing.
Yes.
And he also used the word lav wall. It's like something you'd see on a lav wall. And I'd never heard lav. I'm from where we say bog. So I'd heard bog and shitter, but never lav, because it's short for lavatory, which is pretty elegant, you know. So he'd used this word, FCK, 17 times, and then said, like something on a lav wall. And I thought, all you're doing is proving my point. If I were you, David, I would have written that letter and not mentioned FCK at all. Because as I just said to you, you just branded me 18 times. Excellent. You said the products, names, 17, 18 times. Great. So I was highly amused by it. And he misunderstood a few things. Bless him. He misread the asking campaign because I think French Connection were named Clients of the Year because of the impact that the campaign and the brand had had. And he read that as Campaign of the Year. And they're fundamentally different things. And we didn't win Campaign of the Year. But he kept referring to it as Campaign. How dare you, as our industry bible, refer to, make it Campaign of the Year? And they hadn't. So it was lovely. I did a talk in India that year, and it was like a big deal. Since I got this, all that anyone wanted to talk about, I just found it really amusing. It was great.
Yeah, it's pretty odd because obviously I have massive respect and worked for Dave for a little while. But
we have more in common than he realised.
I'm sure. But the funny thing was, like, he's saying put FC UK up and then kids know they've seen a swear word or whatever. That would then suggest that kids know what the word fuck is already. In which case, what's the problem?
That was my fundamental argument. And my follow-up poster to that was wash your mind out. and think my clothes off. Because unless you know there is a word fuck, you don't know that the word has been misspelt. And they would constantly say that in the complaints. They would say, how do I explain to my child that you've misspelt a swear word? My answer was, I don't know, because your child doesn't know the word fuck. And it isn't the word fuck. The only reason your child knows the word fuck is you must have said it, or worse than that, written it down.
Yeah.
Because your child would assume it's spelled F-U-K. So it was a non sequitur of an argument, but more fundamentally important than any of that, it was the most branded piece of work I ever did in my career. It's French Connection, United Kingdom. That's it. So there's no getting away from that. It was just, it couldn't be for anything else. And under the Rod Allen rule, that made it a fine piece of work, you know. That was the start of it. It went on too long, and, you know, we all know the story. But as a starting point, it was a good piece of work.
Next on my list, because they're all in random order, is why did you leave TBWA when you did? Because it was a huge surprise. Like, how you seem to keep it very under wraps, and it was a big shock to a lot of people. What was the thinking there and the timing?
That was Bill Bungay. It's his bloody fault. Bill always used to say to me, you'll never make it in this business until you do your own shop. And if he said it once, he said it a million times. And whenever we get drunk, he would always say that. He'd always say, well, you're quite good, but you'll never make it until you do your own shop. And every now and again, he'd say, when are we doing it then? When are we doing it then? And I knew that surprise, fear and surprise of it. Surprise was the clue to it. And so one day I went into Bill's office and said, come on, let's do it. And then we did it weeks later. There was no planning went into it. We just did it. And deliberately did it that way because I wanted the surprise to have a repercussion among clients who would say, oh, hang on, I've heard about this. What's this situation? Let's talk to them. It was completely premeditated in that respect, but not over a long period of time. It was a matter of weeks.
And were you not in any way bound by not being able to take clients or any of that sort of stuff?
We couldn't. No, we couldn't take McCain, who I loved, and we weren't allowed to do that. And so we had to wait while they ran the contract out for a year, and then McCain made us pitch for that account because they were very honourable.
Yes.
Well, thanks, lads. So they made us pitch for the account against JWT and against BBH, wherever it was, for our first account. So, you know, there's seven of us pitching for a £20 million account. And we won it. And we'd rented two floors in Covent Garden. And the second floor, which you'll know was floor one, we were keeping for, that's where the McCain people are going to go when we win the account. And again, that was a gamble and a bold thing to do because it broke us. It cost so much money to do that on the gamble that we were going to win the account. And we won the account. But it is the best thing that ever happened to B&B because if that account had come in, we wouldn't have pitched as hard and as energetically as we did for everything else.
Right.
Because it would have made us lazy and complacent and, hey, we've got this account, so let's just furnish and look after this account, hire people to work on it, and then worry about pitching for other things. I'm exaggerating a bit, but I think that would have been the mindset. So instead, we had a year of having to pitch to feed ourselves, and at the end of it thinking, well, we might not win McCain anyway. Chances are we won't. So we need to win other things. So it was very good for our soul that that happened.
Right. And you had a good long relationship with Bill, and you were even producing work when you were, I believe, chairman of TBWA, doing the Michael Jackson Channel 5 stuff. How did you guys team up, and is there any secret to the longevity of your relationship?
Yeah, we're probably because we're ships that pass in the night, and we're, I wouldn't say we're opposites, but we're very psychologically different. Bill is a perfectionist and a craftsman, and he's patient and he's kind and he's gentlemanly, and I'm kind of the opposite. I'm more impulsive, and I get bored with an idea really quickly, and so I'll say, here's an idea, let's do this, and then he'll craft it for hours and days, well, used to be able to, hours and days and weeks and months, and I'll go on to the next thing. So I'm more impulsive in that respect, and you can't both be both, I think. So that's probably why it works. Bill is always the voice of reason in my life. I don't listen to many people, but I do listen to Bill. Honestly, I do listen to him. I don't always believe and act on what he's saying, but I genuinely listen to him. He's a voice of kind reason in my life. We all need that.
Absolutely. My next one is, you were one of the first people to buy a ticket for Virgin Galactic. What's the space obsession all about?
Good, proper subject at last. Excellent. I'm doing a talk next week. I can reveal I'm doing a talk to Typo Circle. And the title is Advertising is a Vehicle Which Will Fly Me to Space. And that's the truth. You know, have you seen The Man Who Fell to Earth, the Bowie film, Man Who Fell to Earth?
Yeah.
Nicholas Rogue. And Thomas Jerome Newton in that film, all that he does is he invents things and makes money in order to build the craft to take himself back home. And when I saw that film, I was wowed by that analogy. And it lived with me forever. And the only thing I've ever wanted to do in my life is go to space. So when advertising came along and it was successful for me, I just used it to go to space. So whether it's commercials for Carling about space, or whether it's earning a lot of money, or whether it's ultimately now proudly counting Buzz Aldrin as a friend, everything was geared quietly towards getting me to space. So when Richard Branson said that he was going for the X Prize, I phoned him up and said, right, I'll be there. I'll be there next week when you do it. And he said, well, I'm not going next week, I'm going tomorrow. So, okay, well, I'll make it the effort, we'll go tomorrow. So off I went to LA, and they won the X Prize, which gave them the license, if you like, to fly commercial spaceflight. And I signed up that day. And there's been bumps along the way and all of that, but I'm going to space. I'm going to space because of advertising. And it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. Everything else is a big scam.
I think that's a great lesson for us. What game are you really playing, I think?
I think you're totally right. And I think that the advertising agency, if we're still allowed to call it that, is the one place, I believe, where whatever your ultimate creative desire, you're best off starting an ad agency, and it's still valid.
Yeah.
I think if you join a design company right now, then your chances are you'll become a designer. I think, you know, these kids here, B&B, I have got no idea what they'll be doing in 5 years' time. But because we're an ad agency, they could be writing screenplays, they could be acting, they could be photographers, designers, they could be strategic thinkers, they could be novelists, they could be painters, all because of advertising, and because of an advertising agency, and it gives you that scope. And now, with the new world we live in, even more so, you know, you can be whatever you want to be. Look at you, Ben. You're the first person. You're the person who introduced me to the internet, pretty much.
How did you?
It's almost true, that is. It's your initial blog was the first blog I'd ever read.
Oh, I'm honoured.
It was a long, long time ago, but it was massively successful and massively read and influential and troublesome, and which obviously is a list of things I like. But yeah. It was literally the first blog I read was yours, and there was a whole new world. There's someone who's joined, who's from an ad agency, is now exploring this whole new world, and now look at it all. Look at you. So, you know, that's what I've always believed about ad agencies. And my purpose in life is to go to space. But the best way of getting there is via an ad agency, I believe.
Great advice. Yeah. And you mentioned very tangentially David Bowie there. I'm going to think that there's a lesson to be learned from David Bowie in terms of life here. Do you want to explain what you think that lesson is and how great a guy he is?
Well, it's hard. It's very hard for me to know where to start, because I could do 2 hours on David. I started this year with four creative heroes, lifelong role models, who I can't remember not being in my life, and they've guided me through my life, thick and thin. They would do something crap with their lives, and I would think, good, I'll try and not do that. And they would do something incredible with their lives, and I'd think, I'll aspire to try and do that. And that was January 2016. By June, there was only one of them left, and he was 86 years old. And those guys were Bowie, Prince, Ali, and Buzz Aldrin. And of all of them, the person who's had the single most influence on my life is Bowie. To go through all that, to sit as a kid and watch Bowie sing Starman on television and have it change my life, to go from there to then hire Duncan Jones as Prince, the third creative at B&B, to then go on and make Moon with him, and to be able to say that Duncan is my friend when I grew up with him as Zoe Bowie, just blows my mind, really. I find it properly affecting, you know. I don't know, losing David was just, it's difficult to even talk about, because it was just a guiding light. It was a guiding light, you know. He was a white man who got me onto soul music. That's incredible. But he was a guiding light. I just looked to what he did all the time. And then out of the blue, when he released Where Are We Now as a single, I just found it profoundly moving, that song. I find it difficult to listen to that song now. I know everyone talks about Black Star and Lazarus and their implications, but for me, it's Where Are We Now is just a devastating song. And in our online world, it's such a testament to the man that he asked those involved not to say anything, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's impossible in our world, isn't it? That someone would not blab something or say something. And because of the stature and the importance and the nature of the man, everyone involved in the project kept stum, and he released it. And he did similar with Black Star and Lazarus. You know, fast forward, I went to see Lazarus just off Broadway, you know, that Wicked opened last year, just over a year ago now. And it really troubled me. I found it really difficult. And that was the opening week. And I didn't know what to say about it because I didn't enjoy it. I found it really difficult. And, of course, a week later, I knew why I found it difficult. Because a week later, I found out what it was about. Because I'd always been led to believe that it was Manifold to Earth, which is one of my favourite themes, as I'd said. So I go to the theatre expecting to see Manifold to Earth, and it isn't Manifold to Earth. It's nothing to do with Manifold to Earth. That was a scam. That was a trick to make you see wide. And I didn't understand the message at the time. It took, you know, a week later, we all knew the message. So I was so moved by the play and so disturbed by it, and I didn't know why I was disturbed by it, because I've been looking forward to it for 6 months, you know. And to go and see that play and be so profoundly affected by it meant that subliminally I'd got the message he was sending, which is, whoa, some stuff going on there, you know. special man.
Yeah, I mean, I live in the woo-woo world of California, and I can't help thinking that energy can exist in that way, in that you there was something that we knew, or something that some of us knew, that was there in the world to be, you know, I don't know, accepted and realized, but, you know, you can't put your finger on it. But on a slightly lighter note, have you got a favorite Bowie album?
I've been thinking about that so much recently. It has to be Hunky Dory. But in terms of songs, it's Starman, because Starman changed my life, you know. So there's a disconnect. Starman wasn't on Hunky Dory, but it has to be Hunky Dory because of the... It's such an eclectic mix of songs. I played my brother. My brother's a huge Bob Dylan fan, and he'd never heard song for Bob Dylan. And really? And I played it him last year. I thought, but hang on, you must have heard this, and he hadn't heard it. And there's so many great songs that, because they weren't singles, people haven't heard, you know.
Yeah.
And Kooks is about Duncan, so, you know, it's a circular thing.
I got married to Kooks.
Wow.
It's a sort of special song for me and Gabby. I don't know. It's just so lovely and warm.
Mm.
Anyway, but okay. But let's just keep on with Duncan a little bit, because you produced Moon, and did you produce the one after that as well? Was it Time Code or?
What was that? No, Source Code. No.
Source Code.
No, not Source Code. No, we did Moon together, and then the plan was to make Mute straight afterwards, because Mute was actually written before Moon. But Duncan, as a result of Moon coming out, was in demand, and then the team came along from Source Code, and they said, look, we've got this script, it's ready to go, we've got the actors. Jed Gyllenhaal personally came along and said, Duncan, I want you to direct Source Code. And Duncan and Stuart sat me down and said, we've got some serious news for you, Trevor, we're not doing Mute next, we're doing Source Code. Well, that's okay. And they went and did Source Code. And it was their first proper exposure to Hollywood and all its horrors and joy and all the variety of cuts you have to do, edits. So they did that, he did that. And then after that, well, how about you now? Well, actually now I've going to do World of Warcraft for 3 years. So there was that. But you only have to look at Duncan on Twitter to see that. Moon has become this weird cult. Moon has a cult following like we never expected. You know, and he's handled his man-made Moon. But he has this group of fans who just talk about Moon all the time in a massively obsessive way. And because they know so much about Moon, they always knew that he was always going to do Mute. So now Mute is being made. They have a special delight, you know. But he's one special lad, one special man, Duncan is. He's the loveliest man you'll ever meet. You know, I always feel like I'm some kind of Neanderthal when I'm around him, because he's such a... he's so polite and so... He's a proper gent, you know. As my mum would say, properly brought up. You know, which you might find surprising, but he's properly brought up.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising and not surprising. Because David's such a decent guy, but that must have been a really great project for you, because it was space and Bowie in a way. So, I mean,
absolutely.
Chuck Muhammad Ali in there, it would have been perfect.